Our next speaker is Rob Moore. Rob is a computer engineer and an attorney in Boston, practicing primarily in the areas of complex litigation and personal injury. He was formerly a staff attorney at the Public Health Advocacy Institute, a think tank in Boston, where his work dealt with legal approaches to the obesity epidemic and the intersection of law, public health, and technology, areas in which he still maintains a keen interest. He is the editor of a treatise on toxic torts published by Thomson West, and his work has been published in several places, including Massachusetts Lawyers Weekly. This is his third time presenting at APHA annual meeting. Please join me in welcoming Rob.
Hello, everyone.
Hi.
Hello, Rob.
Hi.
Hello.
Thanks for coming out on this All Saints Day. It's probably would have been more appropriate if I delivered this talk yesterday, because what I'm about to tell you is absolutely blood-curdling. I'm going to talk about advertising and where we are, where we're going, and what, we, if anything, we can do about it. What I wanted to do when I undertook this project was to do as comprehensive a look as possible at all the players that are involved in advertising online and systematically assess what pressure we could apply to any of them to curtail what are demonstrably the excesses of advertising. Given the political climate today, I wanted to focus on things that localities and or individuals could do rather than state or federal government. And what I ended up finding was very dispiriting. So I'm going to talk now about the problem of advertising going forward, how it impacts public health, and how, unless serious steps are taken, it stands to pose an even graver threat to public health in the future. Then I'm going to talk about what you can do about it. And finally, once I've illustrated the paltry options available to us, I'm going to drive home this point. We have ceded sovereignty, and this fact will seriously impair our ability to go and effect meaningful interventions against advertising. It's unclear how we can possibly get the sovereignty back. On top of that, things are great. So here's a truism. There are many public health crises that are really the byproduct of bad decision-making on an epidemiological scale. Smoking, teen pregnancy, and the focus of most of my research, obesity, are just a few of those. I think the evidence is pretty clear that advertising plays at least a major role in a lot of these public health crises and widespread failures in decision-making. This stands only to get worse. And I'm sorry if this is old hat for anyone, but it does bear mentioning. It used to be advertising in the olden days was Don Draper sitting in a room drinking until inspiration hit him, and he figured out how to sell something. He didn't have an enormous amount of data in front of him. He sometimes he'd have a consultant, sometimes he'd have focus groups, which would be a few people in a room chiming in on messaging or on a particular product. But despite this dearth of information, Draper and his team would come up with a campaign. The whole marketing scheme that would be rolled out over a series of months in popular magazines, radio shows, TV, etc. It was impossible for Draper to go and adjust this model on the fly. If some part of this advertising campaign wasn't working, he couldn't just go and scrap it, nor could he go and tailor it to specific subsections of that audience, nor could he tailor it to individual members of that audience. It was very difficult also to measure any given ad's effectiveness. Was this boost in sales a byproduct of an ad? Was it a byproduct of the economy turning up, the competitor going out of business? It's hard to account for those things, or it was back then. Well, now Draper's going to be looking for a job some point in the near future. Advertising, if you think of it as the art of convincing someone to buy something, is quickly becoming a science. When you go online, everything you do teaches advertisers about you. The whole world is basically a focus group. It's virtually impossible to go online without the details of what you do being stored by someone, or most likely, a lot of people. And over time, the accretion of this information about you will let advertisers in on your decision-making process, at least a little bit. But piece by piece, advertisers will learn how to make ads that will appeal to you. And these ads that are designed just for you will be able to be sent just to you, because the technology is there to automate the process of creating many of these ads. And we all have our own little screens. We have our own iPhones, we have our computers, etc. So the message can be sent narrowcast to you. And it bears mentioning that you don't actually have to be doing anything online to go and leave a digital footprint. Every one of us is, well, not necessarily every one of us, but most people, I think, nowadays are carrying around GPS-enabled devices that are going and transmitting information that is collected by someone at all times. There is an article in The Guardian in April, for example, about how the iPhone does that. So if you accept the proposition that ads that were made back in the day, the Don Draper style, that were broadcast over the course of months, affected public health, contributed to the bad decisions that we as a population were making, then it stands to reason that ads that are engineered to specific customers' preferences, their locations even, and narrowcast to specific customers will be even more effective and therefore will contribute to even worse decisions. So, prognosis, public health, disaster. What can we do? Well, the goal of any intervention in this area has to be the protection of personal information, which is information about who you are and what you do online. This is really the essence or the lifeblood of digital marketing. An intervention, as I see it, could take one of two forms. You could either affect the technological standards that govern the internet or safeguard the transmission of personal information itself. With respect to the former, the name of this talk is Code is Law is Public Health. I lifted the phrase Code is Law from Larry Lessig, who's a Stanford law professor, who pointed out that the protocols for technology that ensure interoperability between devices and between programs have, in some ways, the force of law. If a technological device or program fails to comply with these protocols, these agreed-upon standards, then it won't be interoperable, which is basically renders the technology useless. So it has sanctioning power, and in that sense, it's like a law. Is there anything we can do? I ask myself, is there anything we can do so that the protocols that devices and programs use to connect to the internet and to each other will safeguard personal information? And what I found was no. The internet started off as a U.S. initiative, but over time we have conferred both tacitly and overtly the authority over the internet to industry consortia and international bodies that are captured by industry consortia. So let's run through a couple of major protocols to illustrate. Now, each device that's connected to the internet has a unique number assigned to it, an IP address, Internet Protocol address, so that traffic to or from that device can find it, internet traffic, that is. The protocol by which IP addresses are assigned is determined by an entity called ICANN, which stands for the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. In 1998, this entity was created to handle several of the functions that were previously administered by the government, including the administration of the assignment of IP addresses and the protocol for the creation and ownership of domain names, in particular the extensions .com, .biz, .org, etc. ICANN is a nonprofit corporation, so it is a private actor, albeit one that's headquartered in California. The UN has been demanding some say over ICANN's actions for a long time, and it probably will get it at some point. In an ideal world, ICANN would be a great place for an intervention. It's ostensibly run by an elected committee. It holds several open meetings a year. It regulates content already. It rescinds domain names for cyber squatters and spammers, for example. something ICANN could do. ICANN could establish a protocol by which certain IP addresses were assigned only to devices that didn't accrete personal information, for example. And browsers could default to loading pages only from those IP addresses. Or ICANN could create a child-friendly domain extension. .kid was my suggestion. Reserved for websites that, among other things, did not gather personal information. In other words, doing what the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act sought to do and failed miserably at. Browsers in child-safe mode could block, could be set to block any website that didn't end in that extension. But in reality, ICANN is opaque and virtually impenetrable. And that's not my words. That's how ICANN is described by ICANN's own subcommittee, the At-Large Advisory Committee. Say you want to vote for a committee member who's in favor of your intervention. Well, you have to apply to ICANN to be a member, and they're not accepting applications right now. Say you want to attend one of its meetings and raise the issue of your intervention at it. Well, I hope you saved your frequent flyer miles, because it's probably in Kenya. In 2010, they were in Kenya, Colombia, far-off places. Let's talk about another protocol. Web browsers interpret information in a few standard programming languages, the main one being HTML. The standards and functionality that are built into HTML, in other words, the functionality that will appear in your browser, are determined by the World Wide Web Consortium, W3C. Like ICANN, W3C would seem to be a great place to start if you wanted to do something about advertising on the web. W3C could, for example, omit location-specific functionality from HTML, which would really kind of neuter location-specific targeted advertising, which is a good thing, I'd say. And don't worry, you could probably still use your iPhone to get directions, because that's an app, doesn't use HTML. But anyway, W3C is also, however, like ICANN, in that it is absolutely impenetrable. Membership applications are granted at W3C's discretion with no published standards. Membership dues are $7,900 a year for American nonprofits, and trust me, you don't want to know how much they are for for-profits. Astronomical. And if you actually want to attend a meeting, you have to, again, be prepared to travel to Singapore or someplace like that. As one W3C member said, the process of overseeing HTML is stacked in favor of multinationals with expense accounts who can afford to talk on the phone for 2 hours a week and jet to world capitals for meetings. So, to summarize, the U.S. at one point owned the Internet. You could affect Internet governance during that halcyon age through the regular American democratic processes. Back when we had functioning American democratic processes. Piece by piece, we gave away, through action or inaction, this authority. And now, if you want to, say, prevent advertising on the web from getting too great a grip on us, you have to turn to these monolithic multinational organizations designed to appear democratic but to act plutocratic. Or you could sue. Which brings me to the other form of an intervention I identified earlier, safeguarding the transmission of personal information on the Internet. The strategy here is this. Your personal information en route to whoever's going to gather it up travels through many hands. First step, identify all those hands, everyone that touches your personal information. Second step, find out what responsibility they have to safeguard your personal information. And finally, those that have failed to uphold their duty, and those that you can, sue. The thought being, if you can break one link in the chain transmission of your personal information, then the chain itself fails. So let's go through a very quick example of how traffic can work on the Internet. You go to a website by entering it in your browser. Your computer then transmits a request for that information at that website to your router. The router then sends the request to your Internet service provider, your ISP, Verizon, Comcast, etc. The ISP's router translates the destination for your request into an IP address, determines the best route your request should take to get to its destination, and sends the request along the route. A few stops later, the request arrives at the destination. Here, the server that hosts the information that was requested, the web page. The destination processes the request and submits a response, the data that comprises the requested web page. The response goes through basically the inverse of the steps the request took before arriving at the user's computer, where his browser takes that information and interprets it into the graphics, text, and functionality that comprise the requested web page. So, bottom line, once a user chooses to do something as simple as access a web page and has a very simple network, even still, lots of parties know about that decision. In our example, the ISP, the server hosting the requested website, and any stops the request or the response made en route to their respective destinations probably gathered up information about that decision. And those entities would also know about the email that you sent in Hotmail, or the CDs you bought on Amazon, or the fact that you bought CDs, because that's weird, who does that anymore? This personal information, who you are, what you do, and what prompts you to do what you do, is exactly what advertisers are after. And with it, as we discussed, they can make ads that do a better job appealing to your particular decision-making processes. So let's look at each of those entities in this example that transmit, if not gathers, personal information and see if we can do anything about it. Spoiler alert, we can't. The company that created the operating system that runs on the computer you use to request the web page or send the email or buy the CD on Amazon probably had you agree not to sue it for any transmission of personal information as part of the terms of use agreement that you agreed to the first time you booted up the computer. And anyways, that's what it says in the shrink wrap license. The 900-page document that no one ever reads because it's 900 pages and because it's really small print and it's very laborious. And it also says, on that same document, it says on page 487, I believe, that you can't bring a class action suit, which is a real problem because most of the time you're talking about nominal damages. And it also says if you're going to, any dispute you have with them goes to arbitration and they choose the arbitrator. So those are out. Router and the company that made your browser, same difference. What about the destination? Probably not. It would be a pretty novel claim, I think, if you were to sue, say, ESPN.com and say, hey, you're gathering my information. Because, among other things, ESPN would say, hey, your browser has the ability to go and block cookies, the little bits of data that we store on your computer to track you. You chose to go and enable this cookies for your browser, and therefore you have tacitly agreed to allow us to collect all your information. Never mind the fact that most websites won't work if you go and disable cookies. The most promising of these as a target is your ISP. Under the Cable Communications Policy Act of 1984, cable operators, including ISPs, are obligated to protect the personal information of their subscribers. This duty entails notifying customers in writing each year their privacy rights, including what personal information is collected and how it will be used or disclosed, giving consumers access to whatever information they've gathered, and destroying personal information no longer necessary for the goal for which it was gathered. So, assuming the ISP didn't insert an arbitrage clause into its terms of use, some of them don't, actually. You can sue any ISP that doesn't tell you every year about your privacy rights and what info they're collecting. You can even sue them for nominal damages. If you get a whole bunch of people together with nominal damages, bring a nice class, you might even get a payday. But you probably won't be able to convince them not to collect personal information this way. There could be some state laws under which you could sue your ISP. California's Computer Crime Law and Invasion Privacy Act have been used in this respect. There was at least one federal court that ruled recently that these laws can be applied to protect anyone's privacy, not just California residents. In these cases, you would just need to establish personal jurisdiction over the defendants. In other words, the court would just have to go and determine that there was enough of a connection between those defendants and the jurisdiction of California that the court can go and exercise judgment over it. In this line of cases known as the Nebuad cases, California District Court asserted personal jurisdiction over out-of-state ISPs that allegedly sold customers who lived out-of-state personal information to a targeted advertising firm that was based in California. Those customers settled their claims against the advertising firm for between $1,000 and $5,000 apiece and a cool $800,000 to the attorneys. To my knowledge, the claims against the ISPs haven't been resolved yet. So this might be a good case to follow, see if it serves as a model for this type of litigation. And now I will synopsize. Advertising, public health problem. Quick editorial. Public health advocates have been absent from the debate over how the internet should be governed since basically day one, I think. And because of that, the internet governance has evolved in a way that doesn't reflect public health considerations. And so now we're left with this problem. We have advertising that's clearly going to have an effect on public health if it doesn't already. And we have very little we can do about it. Certainly, there's been a general deregulation, laissez-faire shift, I would say, in government since the dawning of the internet that has contributed to this. But nonetheless, it's really high time that public health-minded people got involved in the battle over how to regulate the internet. As for next steps, I don't know. Organize a boycott, occupy Silicon Valley, I don't know. But maybe I will next year. Stay tuned. Or maybe one of you will. Thanks.
Question.
Oh, sorry. Any questions?
Yes. I have two questions. The first, you mentioned a little bit about blocking the cookies.
Yes.
If I know, okay, correct me if I'm wrong. If I know Google Chrome blocks all the cookies at this point, and IE9 allows users to choose to block certain companies' cookies. Am I correct? So is this type of technology able to decrease the issues of digital footprint? That's my first question. My second question is really related to hacking. Like Sony's PS2 got their cloud computing server got hacked twice. Right?
Yes, I think it was a PS3.
Of the user's driver that got exposed to got on the web. Is there any legal responsibility that Sony needs to take, or is there any, I don't know. It's just that for one point, a lot of people said that it's an embarrassment, but Sony can get over it, and that's it. So, I don't know.
All right, those are good questions. The first one was with the advent of browsers that at the very least enable users to choose whether they want to go and have cookies on their computers. Does that solve the problem of digital marketing, or does it do anything for it? Giving users the options has been a feature of browsers for a while now. I'm not positive if Google Chrome blocks every cookie. I suspect not. Because cookies are also the technology that are used to go and maintain logins. Like, say you want to stay logged into Gmail on a given computer. If you click that button, it stores a cookie on your machine. Does that do anything for to prevent the accretion of personal information? Blocking cookies is good. But then again, we are rapidly moving beyond cookies. There are now flash cookies, for example, which is a technology that stores cookies in haphazard directories on your computer, and it's much harder, whereas cookies are stored in a very defined directory on your computer. And you can go and delete them. but it's a little bit harder to delete these flash cookies. Not sure where they are. Can I just answer the second question, and then I think there was another one, and then I'll get to you quickly. As for hacking, I'll just simply admit my ignorance on this. Off the top of my head, I would say that clearly people that gather personal information have a duty to protect it. That's my initial instinct. Okay? And you had a question? Okay.
Mostly I'm just curious about how accessing the internet through apps is different than accessing the internet through email.
You had a second question?
I did. It has to do with net neutrality. And if net neutrality, if the net becomes unneutral, or people can now, if ISP providers, or I'm sorry, if internet providers can throttle or control what you are able to access through your, if they then have a greater responsibility to protect the information, or maybe that they, you can then opt in or opt out of having your information sold if you're paying to access certain things or to get certain services from your ISP.
Okay, those are also really good questions. Yeah, I mean, that Wired article was kind of, I think, sounding an alarm a little bit prematurely, but clearly there is a trend towards away from World Wide Web navigation of functionality towards these closed garden app style of accessing functionality. And yes, you are correct that we are now willfully giving up a lot of personal information and downloading these apps that we weren't necessarily giving up before. It's troubling. This is kind of a societal trend towards decreased worry about privacy, and I think the value of personal information is not apparent to most people, and what is actually being done with this personal information is also not apparent to people. It's very troubling. The second question was about net neutrality and ISP, whether ISPs have a greater responsibility if there is no net neutrality. In other words, if they can go and control traffic in favor of certain applications or certain types of traffic. And I would say yes. It used to be back when the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was enacted, it used to be that ISPs were just dumb terminals, and that's why Congress said to them, don't worry about it, any copyright infringements. You don't have to go and police your own networks. We'll just treat you like dumb terminals. That's what they argued they were. But if they are going to go and regulate content and regulate traffic, then I would say, yeah, they do have a greater responsibility to go and see what personal information is being broadcast. Absolutely.
More as a consumer here, have you spoken to the race? I mean, you're in Massachusetts, which is Hacker Heaven's second only to Palo Alto, and I know there's a certain amount of traffic between Palo Alto and Cayman. Have you spoken to some of the brain trusts over there, or what is their... I mean, have you given this at MIT? Have you, you know...
I haven't given this talk at MIT. The brain trust, I think hackers...
Were, you know, the kids who are actually doing the hackathons and,
yeah.
You know, creating the, you know...
At one point, I was one of those kids. Those are my peoples. But it's a decentralized group, it's fair to say. It's a very libertarian bend to it. I don't think they would like my presentation very much.
No, I mean, like I said, I have one of those in my house, you know, one of the, you know, persons who can hack into anything, and, you know, it makes me nervous, because, you know, but I also know that, I don't know, I just kind of, you know, I see you from Massachusetts, and I just wonder what their thoughts are, other than that they...
Allow me to speak on behalf of the entire state of Massachusetts. I haven't spoken to Google. I have spoken to Comcast. Comcast, not receptive. I don't know. I have an ongoing feud with Comcast for a lot of reasons. But yeah, it's the word Comcast means nothing to me anymore.
Maybe a better question is, have you considered bringing your own class action lawsuit since you work at a law firm?
I mean, I work defendant side. So it'll be a little awkward for me to go and bring my own lawsuit.
Okay, I wouldn't have asked that question.
But I don't know. Who knows what the future will bring? I do know people who are interested in bringing these types of lawsuits. They're not just in Massachusetts, though. There's lots of wicked smarties up there. Mm-hmm. That's true.
We can go out on one little bit here, but do you think the underlying issue here really is that people, or maybe potentially individuals, undervalue their own privacy, that they don't evaluate it, they don't have the capacity to evaluate it as they evaluate the marketplace, and that maybe also it is not personally identifiable information is not seen as belonging to the individual, it's seen as belonging to, you know, not treated in the same way as any other property would be in the marketplace.
Yeah. The question was, is the underlying problem really just that people don't value their personal information enough and or don't understand how it's valued by the marketplace? And, yeah, that's definitely the case. I don't know what the solution is. We have people who are being conditioned, not people. Everyone is being conditioned to just agree. I have a real problem with these click-wrap licenses, for example. The iPhone App Store updates every month or something, and every time it's 1,000 pages. Am I supposed to go in? I don't know what they change. It's impossible to keep up with that, and that's purposeful. They are trying to keep us in the dark, and I don't know what the solution is. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.